For your panel today, you have to my left Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my right Justice Bill Meyer, and I am Sue Walker. We have two cases set on our oral submission docket for this afternoon. And counsel, I understand you have spoken with the clerk and announced the time you would like to argue, and if you are ready to proceed, we will call the first case. Thank you.
The court would now call Mitchell Reitman and Melinda Reitman versus Roger L. Yandell. May it please the court, Ms. Andrea Dureza will argue for the appellate. Mr. Dan Price will argue for the appellate.
You may proceed.
Please the court, Justice Walker, Justice Kerr, Justice Meyer. My name is not Brian Haynes. As you may be aware, I entered a notice of appearance as co-counsel for Mr. Haynes just yesterday. Unfortunately, he has fallen ill. My name is Andrea Baresa, and I will be filling in for him to present the argument today in this matter involving the Reitmans and Mr. Yandell.
Welcome. I'm sorry he had illness.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's the flu, so I'm sure you'd all be glad to know that he did not attend today. The Reitmans in this case have appealed the trial court's final judgment in this matter, which was entered following an arbitration that they opposed. The appeal is taken from the order compelling the arbitration with Mr. Yandell, which resulted in the confirmation of what the Reitmans contend to be an improper arbitration. So the question then is whether or not the trial court properly compelled arbitration in the absence of a signed agreement between the Reitmans and Mr. Yandell. Some of the relevant procedural history of the case, this actually started back in July of 2010. The Reitmans contracted with RLY Construction to build their home in Fort Worth. Mr. Yandell is the owner of that company. And when disputes arose regarding draws that were taken from money that was paid toward the construction and defects in the construction, ultimately litigation ensued. Mr. Yandell, as the owner of RLY, was sued individually in addition to the construction company itself, and there was a motion to compel arbitration, and an agreed order was ultimately entered on December 7, 2010 that permitted the case to be stayed while an arbitration proceeded involving the Reitmans and RLY Construction.
Why weren't your claims against Mr. Yandell brought up in the arbitration proceeding, the first one?
Well, the claims that were brought against Mr. Yandell individually did not arise from the contract. And prior to the entry of that order, Mr. Yandell had taken the position, as is evidenced in the record, that he was not a signatory to the contract, and therefore he did not have to attend mediation or do the other things that were in the arbitration clause in the agreement. The Reitmans, not desiring to mediate or to arbitrate with Mr. Yandell, relied on that position and proceeded, according to the agreed order, in arbitration against RLY with the intention to then pursue their claims against Mr. Yandell individually in the trial.
How do you come to the position that the agreed order only compelled arbitration of RLY's claims when it says it grants the parties, plural, motion to compel arbitration, and the motion to compel arbitration was as to the entity and Mr. Yandell individually?
We do understand what the contents of the motion were and who the movements were in the motion, but if the court will note in the record that there were changes made to the language of the order before it was signed by Mr. Haynes, and that resulted in the language being qualified that the case, the ordered language says it is hereby ordered that the cause it shall be abated until a final award is entered by the American Arbitration Association in the arbitration proceeding between RLY and the Yandells. It did. I'm sorry, between RLY and the Reitmans. It did not reference any arbitration between the Reitmans and Mr. Yandell, and there's no evidence in the
Well, if the proceeding against Mr. Yandell was not stayed, was there any action taken in that proceeding during the arbitration?
It's our position that the case was stayed after Mr. Yandell while the arbitration was proceeding against RLY. And then once that arbitration award was final, the Reitmans then dismissed RLY with prejudice and proceeded against Mr. Yandell in the trial court. Consequently, Mr. Yandell himself filed another motion to compel arbitration. That, to me, suggested that he also believed that he needed to file a motion in order to direct the parties to enforce the arbitration clause.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did your clients object in front of the arbitrator to having their claims against Mr. Yandell arbitrated?
I don't know that that's reflected in the record, Your Honor. I don't have a site that I can direct the court to in response to that specific question. But I would say that I think the controlling issue here is going to be what's required to preserve error under the Federal Arbitration Act. That was the primary basis for the motion to compel arbitration, and the Reitmans did not object or contest the applicability of the Federal Act. Under the Federal Arbitration Act, parties are expressly empowered to appeal a ruling that confirms an erroneous arbitration award, and there are no additional prerequisites such that there would be if the arbitration agreement had been governed by Texas law.
And so is it your position that the FAA removes this situation entirely from the Texas Arbitration Act 90-day provisions?
Yes, Your Honor, because that would result in an inconsistency, and consequently the Federal Act would control. Neither of the parties disputed that the Federal Act governed the arbitration clause. The question was whether or not there actually was an enforceable arbitration clause. And the Reitmans have maintained since the beginning and in every opportunity to the trial court did maintain that they were not obligated to arbitrate with Mr. Yandell.
So what sort of limitations period would apply under the FAA to challenge something like your clients are doing?
Well, I believe that the rules that would apply would be those that I'm going to back up just a moment. In order to pursue an appeal, there are procedural requirements that have to be met within our Texas Rules of Procedure, and those, I believe, would still apply. So a person would need to file their notice of appeal and do all of the steps they would need to take in any appeal. The question is whether or not the Federal Arbitration Act can also, when it applies, can also apply if a party is subject to the Texas Act as well, and where those two acts are inconsistent, I believe that's not the case. You cannot have a situation where a party is obligated to preserve error one way under the Texas Arbitration Act, but they're empowered without having to meet that requirement under the Federal Arbitration Act. The Federal Arbitration Act doesn't absorb and subsume all of the requirements of the state law. I hope that answers your question.
Who had the burden to make sure that Mr. Yandell's claims, that your claims against Mr. Yandell individually were brought forth in the first arbitration proceeding?
Well, I don't believe the Reitmans had an obligation to make sure that the claims were brought when they were the party resisting arbitration in the first place and were relying on Mr. Yandell's position previously stated that he also was not seeking arbitration. If Mr. Yandell wanted to compel arbitration in the first instance, he could have participated in that.
How would he have done that?
The same way that his company, RLY, did. It acted by and through him in initiating the arbitration. The Reitmans did not initiate it. As I read the record, it was actually RLY that brought the proceeding.
But what claims did he have against the Reitmans that he could have sought arbitration on? I mean, isn't the posture a little bit different? Because the entity, the company, had claims for purported breach of contract against the Reitmans, but Mr. Yandell did not individually. So, I mean, I'm just wondering how that would have been initiated in the arbitration proceedings.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I would concede that they were in a different he was standing in different shoes than RLY. I think that the question then is whether the Reitmans were required to assert claims against Mr. Yandell when they were objecting to arbitration. I think that would have put them in an impossible position. They would have either had to pursue claims in arbitration that they didn't think they were required to arbitrate, that Mr. Yandell himself said he wasn't required to arbitrate because he wasn't a party to that provision, forgive me, I spoke too quickly and I've lost my train of thought, so I'm going to back up just a moment.
I have one more question.
Yes.
Did Mr. Yandell ever participate in the predicatory mediation proceeding that was required under the contract before arbitration?
My recollection from the record, Your Honor, is that Mr. Yandell wanted no part, and in fact his counsel struck his name from the signature line of the pre-mediation agreement because he was not a signatory to the contract and therefore couldn't be required to participate.
So even prior to the second arbitration, He never participated in a mediation. Mr. Yandell individually.
If there was a second mediation, I'm afraid that I don't know the answer to that from my review of the record, Your Honor. But I think that what the court's asking is whether the Reitmans then, even though they did not desire to arbitrate, and even though they were resisting arbitration, somehow should have brought their claims against him involuntarily in the arbitration. And I think that that would actually have operated as a waiver of the objection on which they were relying before the trial court. And so because the Federal Arbitration Act was invoked by both parties, and because the Federal Arbitration Act allows a party to appeal an order enforcing an arbitration award, that is the law that the trial court should have applied. And because the trial court entered an order based on an arbitration clause to which Mr. Yandell concedes he was not a signatory, the trial court's order compelling the second arbitration was an error and led to the rendition of an improper judgment.
Counsel, how many, let's start this way. RLY are initials of whom?
RLY are the initials of Mr. Yandell, I believe, and I'm sure that was the impetus for the name.
And who else, what other agent or representative of RLY negotiated with the Reitmans? Anyone else except Mr. Yandell?
I don't know that the record reflects any additional.
I didn't see that. That's the reason I'm asking you. Did he have employees who also attempted to negotiate contracts and try to obtain houses to build?
I don't believe the record indicates that to be the case.
So he's the only one having contact with the Reitmans?
So far as the record reflects. And again, I apologize. I have to defer.
Well, we're talking about where as we're here today listening to you and looking at the case and looking at all the reading, no one else shows up that I have seen having contact with the Reitmans other than Mr. Yandell.
I believe that's correct.
What was the amount of the award in the first arbitration, dollar amount?
I believe it was in excess of $140,000.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Because it's not disputed that Mr. Yandell did not sign the agreement in his individual capacity, the only way that the agreement could fall under the Federal Arbitration Act is if there were case law that allowed a non-signatory to an arbitration agreement to nonetheless enforce it. For this argument, I would ask the court to entertain the opposite scenario. What if we were here because Mr. Yandell had been the party not desiring to arbitrate? Under the case law that's before the court, in particular the Merrill Lynch case, it's hard to imagine that Mr. Yandell could have been compelled against his will to arbitrate this matter when he only signed the agreement in a representative capacity, especially because the claims against him, claims like theft, allegations of forged signatures and the like, aren't the kind of tortious interference claims and other claims that Texas courts have found are to be inseparable from contract claims. So applying that same law, it simply cannot be the case under Texas law that a non-signatory could resist arbitration as a non-signatory and yet at the same time, if he so chose, compel it against the party to the arbitration clause. That inconsistency is not compatible with Texas Supreme Court case law interpreting the FAA, which states that it's intended to encourage arbitration but not to coerce it. And we believe that that's what's occurred in this case. We believe that the trial court erroneously applied Texas statutory law to a arbitration clause governed by federal arbitration law, and in so doing, erroneously determined that Mr. Yandell could compel arbitration of claims under an agreement to which he was not a signatory. We believe that error was then compounded when the court entered the arbitration award that resulted from that arbitration proceeding. And so we are asking that the court reverse the final judgment and reverse the order compelling the arbitration of claims against Mr. Yandell so that those claims can be proceeded on in the trial court. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Price, and I'm here with my client, Roger Yandell, and it is RLY Investments. It's Roger L. Yandell. Before we get going, I want to clear up one thing because I think it matters for the record. This contract was signed in 2008. The actions in dispute occurred between 2008 and 2009. Why does that matter? As an example of the tort that applied to Mr. Yandell, it's been argued that the trust code under the violations of the trust and the property code provisions are exempt. That was effective after all acts and omissions and the contract was signed. It doesn't apply to this case whatsoever. So that timing matters. The contract was signed in 2008. Our argument in this case is really twofold. Number one, the Brightmans failed to preserve their challenge to the arbitration award. And it's been suggested that the TAA applies the 90-day rule, and it's the only statute of limitations that applies. Now, we think that there's overlap here in both the TAA and the FAA can apply to the extent there's not inconsistency. Well, the FAA has a statute of limitations of its own. It's 3 months, and that's in Section 12 of Title IX of the USC. So, regardless of which provision we're talking about, if it's the TAA, there was not a timely filed motion to vacate. If it's the FAA, there was not a challenge to the arbitration award.
What provision of the FAA is that?
Section 12, Title IX of USC. Now, Texas case law does address this question. It is a statute of limitations. In the case of Turner versus Texas Tow Marine and Towing Salvage LLC, which is a 2016 case from Houston, they addressed the question of a party challenging an arbitration award, but they failed to file a motion to vacate, and they were challenging the existence of the arbitration award. That's what we have here. There is no existence of an arbitration agreement. Sorry. That's what we have here. The argument is that there's not an arbitration agreement with Mr. Yandell. The 14th Court of Appeal rejected the argument. They explained, citing federal authority, and held that the motion to vacate, which was just like in our case, was filed in response the day of the motion to confirm arbitration, was inexcusably untimely, irrespective of the lack of agreement to arbitrate. Under the FAA, not the TAA, the FAA, you have to preserve that by filing. That's a threshold issue that we're dealing with here. This court has addressed the issue in an unpublished opinion, and that was Brust v. MBNA American Bank, and the Westlaw site is 2005 WL1047583, held the non-existence of an arbitration agreement as not a ground for vacator under Section 12, Title IX of USC, where the challenger failed to timely file a motion to vacate. The attempts to vacate were therefore time-barred. There's an additional forward case, Slay, holds the same thing, also unpublished. Eastland Court of Appeals has held the 3 months limitation into the FAA covers all attempts to vacate. El Paso said the same thing. A challenger failed to timely file its motion to vacate. The El Paso Court of Appeals explained the trial court had a ministerial duty to deny the motion to vacate and to confirm the award. We're dealing with the threshold statute of limitations question. Not to the standard of review yet. We have to be able to preserve that. So let's not confuse the standard of review saying that we can go back and look at this question, certainly, but we have the limitations period before we can do that, and that wasn't met here. In the timeline, I don't think it's disputed. The arbitration award was delivered in August of 16. The response to the motion to confirm the arbitration award was filed the day of the hearing, 274 days later. It's not even close. Now, we also submit that even if it was timely preserved, then Mr. Yandell still could compel arbitration. He was a non-signatory to the agreement, and that part is not disputed. He was acting as an agent for RLY. like all corporations, they cannot act without the acts of their agents. They're pieces of paper, as we all know.
Didn't the trial court grant Mr. Yondell's motion to compel arbitration in the first arbitration?
Yes, it did.
And so why were his claims not arbitrated? Why were the Reitmans' claims against Mr. Yondell not arbitrated in the first arbitration?
Because the Reitmans chose not to do it. They made an election. We're going to proceed against RLY. And certainly, Mr. Yondell, as a defendant, is not going to raise his hand and say, come after me in this arbitration. Obviously, the posture of the case was such that if you recover from RLY, which they did to the tune of about $149,000, that at the end of the arbitration, you get your award, you get paid, then you'll not sue the agent of the company. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to get more blood out of Mr. Yondell. And so at that point, they reinitiated litigation against him, and Mr. Yondell filed the second motion to compel arbitration, asserting the grounds that were in Merrill Lynch, and suggesting that a non-signatory agent could compel arbitration.
Did Mr. Yondell ever participate in the pre-mediation procedure?
The pre-mediation agreement was never signed. So we're talking about he should be stopped from doing something that was never executed.
But that's required under the contract, is it not? Under the construction contract.
I'm sorry.
Under the construction contract between the entity, RLY Construction, and the Reitmans, a pre-mediation or a mediation agreement before proceeding to arbitration is required.
RLY participated in that. And well, he's an agent of that principle. Now, we're dealing with a situation where he's able to grab hold of that agreement because he's an agent, certainly non-signatory, an agent of the principle. And I would disagree with the assertion that this
But he was sued in his individual capacity, and the claims that were arbitrated in the second arbitration were against him in his individual capacity. So he's not, you're saying he's a non-signatory in his individual capacity, not an agent for RLY.
He's a non-signatory in his individual capacity and a non-signatory as an agent. He didn't sign that. He signed it as the president of RLY, certainly. In his individual capacity, he is a non-signatory, and in that role, he can compel arbitration.
Exactly. So if he can compel arbitration in that role as an individual, as to claims made against him individually, why does he not have to comply with the mediating before proceeding to arbitration?
I would suggest that it's because he's subsumed under the RLY umbrella. He was brought in. He did participate in the mediation as part of RLY. He was RLY. And as an agent of RLY, he's able to compel as a non-signatory. So
you're saying that he can compel arbitration under the agreement for claims brought against him individually, but he individually, as to those individual claims, does not have to participate in pre-mediation, which is mandated under the contract.
And also waived by the Reitmans. Second arbitration, motion to compel, they didn't raise that issue again themselves. So if that issue is counted against Mr. Yondell on the one hand, it's also against the Reitmans. They didn't say we need to go mediate this issue before we go back to arbitration. At that point, it just went back to arbitration.
How did the Reitmans claims change? I seem to remember something about they initially filed their lawsuit, the ROY arbitration took place, and then what did the Reitmans add to the litigation that wasn't in play during the first arbitration?
So the first, remember, the Reitmans filed an original petition. In the original petition, everything was RLY and Yondell. All the causes of action are alleged, the same against the phone. They went back, and the amended petition later named just Yondell, added some DTPA claims, added theft claims, conversion claims. They added the trust claim I referenced. So they directed the acts that he participated in as an agent of RLY and said that they were his acts individually. Now, they concede and they state in the third amended claim for arbitration, which is attached, it's a part of the record at 368 to 369, that Yondell was the sole shareholder, owner, and only employee of RLY, and they state he is individually liable to be the torts of RLY. That's their position in that second arbitration. Further, they state in the same document, the subject matter of the disputes alleged against by the Reitmans against ROI and Yandell are the same. That's their position. That's not mine. They are telling us that these are the same claims, and the Texas Supreme Court tells us we don't look at the causes of action alleged. We look at the facts that are alleged. And here, but for this contractual relationship with RLY, there's no contract to build a home. There's no money changing hands. Mr. Yandell's actions or omissions, whether they occurred or not, would never have occurred. So the facts that are alleged and the facts that are presented in those two different documents are what we have to look at. We look at those documents, we see that these all arise out of his acts as an agent of RLY. Now, I think the Merrill Lynch case, which we both cited, we both discussed quite a bit, it has two aspects of that case. And the first part is an employee of Merrill Lynch, which was sued individually, and they just didn't sue Merrill Lynch to avoid the arbitration provision. That employee, as a non-signatory, the Texas Supreme Court said, could compel arbitration against a signatory. They said that they could do so for two reasons. One is a matter of agency, like we've talked about. The parties to arbitration may not evade arbitration through arbitral pleading, such as naming individual agents of the party to the arbitration clause and suing them in their individual capacity. It notes, corporations can only act through their human agents. If the choice is between suing the corporation or suing the employees, and that determines whether arbitration applies, then the agreements become rendered illusory on one side. Now, it was suggested by counsel that we can't look at the distinction between if it's a non-signatory compelling arbitration or a signatory compelling arbitration. Well, the Texas Supreme Court says, yeah, we're supposed to look to that. And In Re Vesta Insurance Group, and that is cited in our brief, it says that it does matter who's trying to be compelled to arbitrate. Why does that matter? The Reitmans agreed. There's no dispute. They signed a document saying if there's any dispute arising under that contract, any dispute, we're going to arbitrate. Certainly that makes sense. They've agreed to do so. Now, the non-signatory can compel arbitration, and it can, I would agree, try to avoid it. There's a whole line of case law which draws a distinction between when can you compel that non-signatory the other direction to arbitration, and it can be done. Direct benefits estoppel, equitable estoppel, some other cases to talk about that. But that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the non-signatory agent saying, hey, signatory, you agreed to arbitrate. You need to go to arbitration on this and not go to court. That's what you bargained for. That's what you said you would do.
Mr. Price, what cause of action asserted by the Reitmans arose distinct and apart from the construction contract?
I would argue that none of them did. That was the position taken in that second arbitration.
I understand, but what I'm asking you to help me with is I'm looking at agency. I'm thinking agency law, and I'm starting at the top and going trickling down through all of the various trickles that you can look at in terms of agent's responsibility and representative of the superior. And as I read through the briefing and took a short look at the cause of action asserted, I didn't see anything that to me looked like it would have been a happening but for the contract. Everything that's alleged, he's not handling the change orders right, he's getting money from false filings of demands for payments and interim payments and all of the things that were the basis for the separate causes of actions that was the quote separate causes of action looked to me like they were all connected to and related to the construction contract. Wouldn't have had withdrawal of money from the bank but for the construction contract. Would not have had claims under Trust Act, which you say doesn't apply, but for the fact that you had a contract. And I'm just trying to get in my mind what could have been the thinking or the discussions that you all might have had in the trial court about that.
Well, you you stated my position, and I would agree with that. I would have to get back to you on what I would think the cause of action would be that the Reitmans could have brought, or that they alleged it could have been done individually. There are none of them that are coming to my mind.
I didn't see anything in the record that showed that that had been brought up and addressed in the trial court. You didn't file a motion to strike the individual cause of action or any summary judgment, anything like that at all to attack.
There was a res judicata in the summary judgment that did not make it into the appellate record. We asked for that to be supplemented. It was filed at the same time the second motion to compel arbitration was filed, and it just did not make it into the record.
That would be interesting to see. But it's not on the record.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your presentation, sir.
May it please the court, I have just a couple of brief points in rebuttal. First, Justice Walker, with regard to the point that you raised, the agreement to arbitrate under which Mr. Yandell sought to compel arbitration absolutely did require that the parties first mediate. And I did want to point out to the court that in the record at CR 201 to 203 and at CR 205 to 206, the Reitmans did rely on Mr. Yandell's inconsistency with respect to that position and his failure to agree to the pre-mediation procedure in their opposition to compelling arbitration. So that issue was addressed to the trial court and is one of the reasons that the trial court should have denied the motion to compel arbitration.
Counsel, what was the consequence of Mr. Yandell's position you just discussed? How did it, if it did, delay at all the proceedings as you went to the first arbitration?
To clarify, I'm speaking with regard to Mr. Yandell's second motion to compel.
Okay, you passed the first arbitration, but you had
right.
But the only time there was any mediation attempt, even in terms of the draft of a document called a mediation agreement, was prior to the first arbitration, not after the first was finished and prior to the second.
That is correct. And the Reitmans relied on Mr. Yandell's position that he did not need to participate in pre-mediation, in any kind of pre-arbitration mediation, essentially seeking to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted to enforce the motion to compel arbitration, but he didn't want to have to actually comply with the condition precedent. And that inconsistency was pointed out in connection with the estoppel argument that was asserted in the Reitman's opposition to his second motion to compel arbitration. At CR 134, the contract specifically states, disputes hereunder shall be resolved by mediation. So to the extent that Mr. Yandell intended to take the position that the claims against him fell under the contract, he was required to participate. He elected not to participate. His attorney, as evidenced in the record, struck out the line for him to sign individually on the pre-mediation agreement. And he elected not to fulfill the condition that he would have had to fulfill in order to pursue arbitration. Secondly, with respect to whether or not the claims against Mr. Yandell arise under the contract, this case is different from the cases that are cited by the appellee in the brief. Those cases generally involve tortious interference and other, as counsel stated, artful pleading. So if a company has breached its contract, then one of its actors, one of its agents, then necessarily tortiously interfered with it. And so the courts have said, you can't do that. You can't try to get out of arbitration by trying to turn your complaint against the company into a new complaint or a different complaint against one of the individuals. This is not that case. If you look at the claims that were pleaded against Mr. Yandell, they include things like economic duress and extortion and theft and fraud. These are not claims that are incident to performing a construction contract. In other words, we're not just talking about whether or not the workmanship was shoddy. We're not just talking about whether or not there were severe and very serious flaws with the electrical system. We're talking about whether or not Mr. Yandell unlawfully appropriated funds from the bank and or from the Reitmans. Those are very different causes of action. They didn't arise under the agreement, and the court erred in concluding that the agreement covered those claims. So we are asking the court to reverse the final judgment and to reverse the trial court's order that compelled these claims to arbitration. Thank you.
Counsel.
Yes.
Would you please address The argument made by your co-counsel about Section 12 of Title IX, that is a limitation period of 3 months involving the FAA claim?
Your Honor, I'll confess I'm not familiar with Section 12. It's not in any of the briefing that's before the court, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm afraid
I can't
speak to that. What I can speak to is the fact that the section of the FAA that we did cite to in our brief, which I believe is Section 16, does specifically allow parties to appeal from orders that enforce arbitration awards, and they certainly timely appealed the order enforcing the arbitration award, and there's no question that they preserved their error to the trial court by making an objection at every stage to the trial court to the compelling of arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today and for your briefing. They've been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted.